morning and welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for January 18th, 2012. I wanted to welcome everybody. We have one member that is out of town and another member that I know is on the way, but with the weather, I think, a bit slow. I wanted to just walk through the agenda real quickly because we have a pretty full agenda. We're going to continue our informational meeting, hearing on hatchery issues. We heard from the agency, I think, what was the last date? Was it in December?
In November.
In November, we had an intro from the agency. And we're going to hear from a panel of folks this morning, and then there'll be probably continuation of informational hearings in February. The committee is not looking at any committee bills at this time, but we'll be continuing the informational hearings probably in February and through the interim. After that, we have our committee bills that we're going to have informational hearing with invited testimony, and I want to make clear that those bills for the committee members will be looking at bill introduction for the purposes of discussion, and any voting on the bill introduction is just for the purposes of that, and that does not signify your position on the bills. And after the informational hearing, we will have a work session. Then at 10:45, at the end of our hearing, we will continue with an informational meeting on the 10-year energy plan that the governor is working on. And I'm sure we'll have questions on many of those. So with that, we have several people on the phone who I think we're going to first go through and ask who's on the phone so they can introduce themselves. And then we'll call up the folks who are here in the room. So who all is on the phone? I think we have Representative Holvey.
Yes, I just got on. Thank you. And I'll put my phone on mute. If it causes any problems, please let me know and I'll hang up.
Okay, so Representative Holvey is on the phone. Who else do we have on the phone?
This is Peter Packett.
Okay, hi, Peter.
Yeah.
And anyone else? Do we have Jim?
Jim Lickatowicz.
Okay, great. I think what we're going to do is we're going to have the folks come up who are here, and then we'll have a little bit of introduction, and then we'll have Jim and Peter go ahead and give their informational testimony so they can get off the phone if they don't want to stay on, and they can listen via the web. So with that, we'll have Jim Myron. Here's Jim. Come up. I'm going to do an introduction.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelter and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Myron, here representing the Native Fish Society. We certainly appreciate this opportunity to come before you today and make some presentations about some other aspects of the hatchery program that we think it's important for the legislature to know about and learn more about. So with that, I think we can probably just go right into the folks on the phone and get started.
Okay, so who's going to be going first?
Well, we can go the way it's set up in the program.
Okay,
with
so
Jim,
we'll have
Lickatowicz
Jim
first.
Okay, Jim, do you have any slides or anything?
There's a handout that's in your packet.
Okay, apparently we have a handout from you, Jim. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, so why don't you go ahead? You're going to be up first, and then we'll go with Peter. And I was just informed by my staff that there's a handout that you have.
Yeah,
we've got a copy of his summary statement here.
Okay. Got it. Okay, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. First, I'd like to thank the chair and the committee. First, I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for this opportunity to talk a little bit about hatcheries. And I'd like to answer two questions. How did our attachment to hatcheries begin? And why has it persisted in spite of a 135-year record of failure? Our attachment to hatcheries began in 1875 with a letter that Oregonians wrote to the U.S. Fish Commissioner asking what will cause the abundance of salmon to decline and what can Oregonians do about it? The U.S. Fish Commissioner Spencer Baird replied by a letter which was published in the Oregonian, and he said that habitat degradation, dams, and overharvest would reduce the abundance of salmon. That was a problem back then, and it's still the same problem today. But then he went on to say that regulating harvest and protecting habitat will be difficult and ineffective. Remember, during this time, there was a strong laissez-faire access to natural resources. He then offered hope in the form of hatcheries. He said if you adopted hatchery programs, they would make salmon so abundant that habitat protection and regulating harvest would not be needed. So a bargain was struck. Hatcheries would be traded for habitat and rational harvest management. Who benefited by this bargain? Salmon managers got large budgets to operate hatcheries. Developers got access to the river with minimal restrictions, and government leaders got credit for avoiding confrontation between competing users of the river. The losers in this bargain were the fishermen and the salmon-dependent communities, and also the salmon. They were losers because no one bothered to check to see if hatcheries were holding up their end of the bargain. We bought into hatcheries and the myth that an industrial process, hatcheries were called fish factories in the earlier years, could replace salmon-sustaining ecosystems and the result would be a superabundance of fish. So in the beginning, the hatchery's first goal was to break the natural limits on salmon production and increase their numbers so harvest would not need to be regulated and habitat would not have to be protected. And unfortunately, you could still hear echoes of this foolish promise 100 years later in the late 1970s. But by the early decades of the 20th century, it was obvious that hatcheries had failed to achieve the goal of superabundance, and salmon were in decline. So to rebuild enthusiasm for hatcheries, the goal was changed. Hatcheries would now stop the decline and maintain the supply of fish. But the decline persisted. After World War II, the construction of large main stem dams got underway full steam. They had started the construction of main stem dams in the 1930s, but it was after World War II when the program really got going. And hatcheries, once again, in spite of the failure to achieve the first two goals, managers turned to hatcheries to solve the problems posed by the large main stem dams. But once again, in order to sell the hatcheries, they had to change the goal, cloak the old failed tool with a new image. This time the goal was to mitigate for the effects of dams. The decline continued, and by the late 1970s and early 1980s, the continuing decline of salmon began raising questions about the possibility of listings under the ESA. Now, by this time, by any measure, it was obvious that hatcheries had a long record of failure. But that didn't deter the hatchery advocates, and they invested those invested in maintaining the status quo. Hatcheries were once again given a new set of goals: supplementation, conservation, captive brood. Hatcheries, which contributed to salmon depletion, were now going to save them from extinction. As I look back over this history in salmon management's ties to hatcheries, it reminds me of the old saying, if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. 135 years ago, we bought into the myth that salmon-sustaining ecosystems could be replaced by an industrial substitute. By any measure, this has failed, and hatcheries have failed to hold up their end of the bargain that was so confidently struck so many years ago. The evidence that hatcheries, as they are currently used, are part of the salmon's problem has been mounting for the past 30 to 40 years. But all of the reform efforts that have been created in response to this new understanding, and there have been at least three or four during the 40 years that I've worked in salmon management, those three or four attempts at salmon reform have failed to crack the defensive shell that protects the salmon bureau. Now, at this point, I want to make this next point extremely clear. Hatcheries are here to stay. We traded too much habitat for hatcheries, and too many of those trades were permanent, or nearly so. But it's time that hatcheries were made to hold up their end of the bargain that was struck way back then. We should only retain hatcheries that can make the transition from a substitute for ecological processes to a source of production that is in harmony with the attributes and natural rhythms of salmon sustaining ecosystems, and hatcheries that do not negatively impact natural production in wild salmon. One measure of that harmony would be the comparative survival of juvenile hatchery and wild salmon. Hatchery fish survive at a small fraction of their wild counterparts. In other words, if we could correct what we are doing wrong with our hatcheries today, we could have the same level of adult returns from our hatcheries at a much reduced cost. Or conversely, we could have a great many more adult salmon returning to our rivers without a great increase in cost. I'd like to end with this thought. Myths retain their influence only as long as they are not examined and evaluated, and only as long as responsible officials are not held accountable. Because the hatchery myth is so deeply entrenched, I believe that the needed evaluation and accountability can only come from independent outside audits and oversight of the hatchery program. Audits and oversight that bring accountability to the use of the hatchery tool. That's the end of my presentation.
Okay, thank you, Jim. We're going to take questions one at a time for the folks on the phone. So are there any questions for Jim Likatowicz?
Of course.
Senator? And can you say your name so he knows who is speaking?
Mr. Likatowicz, this is Senator Alan Olson, the Vice Chair. You worked for ODFW for 30 years?
No, I worked for ODFW for about, I think it was 17 or 18 years.
Okay, thank you. Did you make your concerns known about hatcheries at that time? And what was the result of your concerns?
I had a reputation of questioning hatcheries. In fact, the lack of response that I received to my questions and concerns, even if those questions and concerns were directed to making the hatcheries work better and produce more fish, you were sort of labeled as a troublemaker, and I ran into what could probably be called a stone wall. The fact that I made such little progress in my attempts to develop a better approach to the use of the hatchery tool led me to, a few years after I left the department, to write the book, Salmon Without Rivers. The book has received an award, and it explains the history of our attachment to hatcheries in considerable detail.
Do you have a follow-up?
No, thank you very much, sir.
Any other questions for Mr. Likatowicz? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. We'll move on to Mr. Packett. Peter, you're still with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear. I'm going to lower you just a little bit there.
Well, thank you very much. I am here today representing the Hatchery Scientific Review Group, which I am currently the co-chair and past chair of the Columbia River Hatchery Scientific Review Group. The HSRG was established by Congress in 1999 to review hatchery programs in the Pacific Northwest with the goal of continuing to provide fish for harvest while at the same time trying to reduce risks to natural populations and contributing to achieving the conservation goals for salmon and steelhead. And this was, I think, particularly important because of the listings for threatened and endangered species for many populations of salmon and steelhead in the Columbia River and the Pacific Northwest in general.
Peter, I'm just going to interrupt you for a minute because I forgot to mention to committee members that there's a packet handout and there's some extras in the back. Unfortunately, we didn't get the PowerPoint to project on the screen, but if folks want to follow along, there's some copies in the back. So I just wanted to mention that, Peter, just to let folks know if they want to follow along with your presentation.
Okay, thank you. And I'll perhaps not go through all of it, just to you know, in the make sure that we're in the right time frame. But I think most importantly is that you know, hatcheries are a huge component of the system. There are over 200 hatchery facilities in the Pacific Northwest. We have the largest hatchery system in the world, certainly for anadromous fish production. And I think, as Jim mentioned, we believe that hatcheries will continue to be part of the production of fish within the Columbia and other systems in the Pacific Northwest. I think the HSRG's assignment was, as I mentioned, specifically to look at how the hatchery salmon and steelhead programs in the Northwest were contributing to both conservation of the various populations and to the harvest. And so our goal was to see how that could be done in a way that best met the scientific principles that I think have been established over a number of years. There have been numerous hatchery reviews conducted probably over the past 15 or 20 years, all of which have reached pretty much the similar conclusions. And the basic premise being is that hatchery fish competing with wild fish on the spawning ground tend to lead in a decline of the productivity of the wild fish. And so how do we balance this sort of a situation, I think, was what the HSRG's basic goal was. And in order to try to address the question, we developed a set of scientific principles based on the most current genetic analyses of the various populations. And the most current population biology with regard to these various populations. And what we tried to do was to look at these in terms of the best available science and see if there was a way to take that science into account and to come up with a solution, so to speak, for each of the various hatcheries within the Columbia River system. And to see if that solution would allow us to meet both the goals of conservation and harvest. And so what we did was we modeled all of the various hatcheries within the system. And essentially, I think we concluded that it is possible to get there and to meet both the goals of harvest and of maintaining the conservation for the wild fish populations. And I think what we've concluded is that, that certainly hatcheries can play a role, but those hatcheries are going to have to be operated in a very different manner in which they are operated today, either as completely segregated operations, which means essentially you keep all of those hatchery fish off of the spawning grounds, which is a difficult proposition, but in some instances may be done, and otherwise more as an integrated program in which we try to maintain the gene frequencies, I guess, of the populations, the wild populations, within the hatchery populations by manipulating those, by maintaining enough wild brood stock within the hatchery system, and preventing many of the hatchery fish from getting onto the spawning grounds, so that we essentially try to maintain the genetic diversity that's needed within those wild populations. And I think the other important thing that we've learned from this is that by maintaining higher productivity within those populations, is that it also provides a large benefit for all of the habitat work that we are currently undergoing in this region, is by putting more productive fish about out into that habitat, we actually increase the productivity of that habitat. That means those fish are using that habitat to a greater ability than if we were simply putting hatchery fish onto those spawning grounds. So I think I would like to, you know, in the end, just to summarize a bit, is that we, and I think that HSRG believes that the kinds of changes that are necessary can be made. I think we have looked at those and provided potential solutions, not that those are actual recommendations, but demonstrate that solutions are possible. But I think the other thing that we've established in looking at this, you can't make these kinds of changes in hatchery operations without also addressing the issue of harvest. Because it's going to be important to be able to establish the differences between both hatchery and wild fish in terms of how we harvest those fish, if we're going to be able to make the kinds of changes necessary within the hatcheries to be able to meet both the conservation and the harvest goals. And I guess lastly, particularly to this group, those kinds of changes aren't going to happen without some substantial funding to make those kinds of changes.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Peter. I have a couple of questions, but we'll see if there's any questions from any of the other members first. No. Rep. Holvey, do you have any questions?
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Well, I'm unsure whether this is the right person to ask or whether ODSW is the right person, but I'm going to go ahead and pose a question. I've been following the news for a year or so about infectious salmon and anemia and the potential impact that has to our wild stock is quite alarming. So I'm wondering if the hatcheries have a protocol in place to test for that disease and also a protocol to prevent that disease spreading from, and the pathogens, that disease spreading into the water that would impact our wild stock I think it's been found that the greatest risk of that pathogen or that disease is coming from aquaculture and non-native species like the Atlantic salmon and also the genetically engineered fish. So I'm curious if you have a response to that.
Peter, could you hear the question okay?
I did hear the question. Well, one, I cannot answer for ODFW mm-hmm. on this, but I think there certainly are concerns over a number of pathogens. I think the issue that was just raised is concern over a specific virus that was purported to come out of some hatchery operations, net pen operations in British Columbia. I think there was a lot of concern as to whether or not they've actually identified this particular virus, which has been has caused severe problems in other parts of the world, particularly in Norway and in Chile. And I think the real concern was the fact that apparently some of these had been partially identified, had not been reported back to folks on this side of the border. So the only thing I can say at this point is I know that raised a large concern and that there have been a number of protocols that have been established and put in place both by the National Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I think working with their state and federal and tribal partners to try to get a handle on this. I believe Congress actually directed National Marine Fisheries Service to redirect some funding to specifically look at this issue.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. We'll have ODFW come up and also address that at the end and see if there's any other questions. Peter, I just wanted to ask about the you list 17 recommendations that the Hatchery Reform Group posed as part of their review. Do you know if any of these have been implemented? And this may be another question for ODFW.
Well, yes, I can at least partially. I think in looking at very recently, I think in November, did a brief review to look at a number of programs throughout the Columbia, and that would be Oregon, Washington, and tribal programs, to see to the extent that a number of these recommendations are being implemented. And I'm finding that to a large extent, people are beginning to implement these types of recommendations.
Okay, and I'll ask the same thing to the department probably when they come up as well. Any other questions for Peter before we let them go? Okay. Senator Olson has a question, Peter.
Doctor, thank you for your testimony today. I do have a question. If in a perfect world we were able to eliminate the hatcheries and eliminate harvest, would we see a revitalization of the natural stock?
That's kind of a loaded question.
It is.
The future.
Well, we want you to get out your crystal ball there,
that's right.
Peter.
I guess I'd have to frame it by saying that given where we are with the amount of habitat that we have today as opposed to what we had historically, and we estimate that maybe 52% of the habitat that was available to salmon and steelhead, you know, historically is no longer available, then I think it's pretty clear that we would not get back to where we were with, you know, kind of the numbers that we saw historically.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. And You're welcome to stay on the phone, or you can also listen via the internet if you would prefer. We'll keep the line open, though, if you want to stay on the phone. With that, we will call up the rest of the panel. So we have Hans Rotke and Bill Bakke. I think that's going to join Jim. And then I'll ask Department of Fish and Wildlife to come up and address that question. I think there might be some other questions for the department. Okay, thank you, gentlemen, whoever wants to go next. And I think we have handouts also. More handouts, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And can you also make sure and state your name?
But I will be summarizing my handouts.
Okay. And can you please make sure and state your name for the record?
My name is Hans Rotke. I live in Yahats, Oregon. And I'm a private consultant for 30 years. I've worked on a variety of natural resource issues from local, state.
You might have to pull the mic up just a little bit.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. Local, state, NGOs, industries, and I've also had the opportunity to work in some projects in Alaska and Far East Russia, especially on hatcheries in Far East Russia. Currently, I've been on the Pacific Fishery Management Council 6 years and 2 years as the chair. Presently, I'm on the Oregon Governance Council of Economic Advisors, and I'm also on the Federal Advisory Committee for Marine Protected Areas, that's for NOAA and the Department of Interior. I'd like to summarize my statement with saying that I support Jim Lichtenthaler's request that we have that Oregon needs an independent review of the status of salmon hatcheries. We know, especially the last few years, science points to some real harmful effects of hatcheries on wild stocks. And therefore, besides the biological, ecological effects, my question is...
Just a reminder to please turn your phones off. Thank
not
you.
Mine.
Apologize.
Sure. We also need an economic analysis. I mean, private business does this, and if we go back to the 1980s, if you remember, Weyerhaeuser had a very large ranching operation on Newport, and after about 5 years, they pulled the plug because their assumptions were too optimistic about survival rates, and the costs weren't covering their returns weren't covering their costs. So if private business does such an economic analysis, I think it's also that the public should also do something similar. I'm aware of economic studies have been done by ODFW, 1999, Chris Carter did that. I'm also aware U.S. Fish and Wildlife did a study on the economics of Mitchell Act hatchery on the Columbia River. NOAA just completed one. And one of the problems with it, and this is why we're asking for an independent studies, is when these studies are done by the agencies, when the results don't quite fit the present policy, the results somewhat get buried. And that's why we're asking for an independent study that then comes back to the legislature, which can give you some information. Now, I'll just go over quickly some results on costs. Costs, basically, we've got a fairly good handle on costs. I've done several studies, and other people have done too. But just give you an example. With coho, they get put out about 15 smolts, little guys, about to the pound. And the cost, close to $1 to raise these fish. Now, if you put 100 of these out, that's $100. And fairly good survival rates, two of them will be harvested. So if you harvest two of them, whether it's commercial or recreational, they'll come in at about So the cost of fish is about $50, and the benefits may be about $15 to $30. So as a private investor, would you invest in that money? No. As a public, should we be investing that? That's why we need to look at this. And you ask yourself, why is the support for the hatcheries in many areas, especially in local areas? We've done some of that work, and the over 50% of the income employment from hatcheries come at the active, at the site of the hatcheries. So the production is what creates jobs. Only a portion of that other 50% will come to the coastal communities and to the harvest and the end result as they spend their money. Of course, when we do look at the Columbia River hatcheries, much of that, those incomes and employment also take place in Alaska, Canada, and so on. So we need a description of how this employment and hatchery actually really does take place. So that's on terms of employment income. When we take a look at classical benefit cost analysis, and we've done that, people have done that, the research group did that as part of the Mitchell Act review, it's at the base case being some survival rates of salmon around the 1990s, early 2000s, the benefit cost analysis is negative. In other words, it costs you more money than you'll get back as a society. Only when you take those survival rates, and survival rates are, you know, they go out, they get eaten by birds, by whiting out in the ocean, and so on. Only when you assume the survival rates to be twice of the base case would you get a positive benefit-cost analysis. And this does not include ecological costs, which economists call externalities. So what we should be doing is, as to make good public policy decision, one is we should be collecting good cost data. Like I said, we have some of that, but we should keep that current. And more importantly, we should be providing good data on survival rates and where they're caught. And to go back to my studies in Russia, one of the things that really, well, impressed me, negatively probably, is they're going into the Kamchatka area in Far East Russia with the same zeal that we're going here, destroying their habitat, pipelines along the Sakhalin, and so on, with the idea, well, we'll make up for that with hatchery programs. And my message to them, it's going to cost you, people. You just take a look at these things before you do it. It's going to cost you. If you destroy your habitat, it'll cost you in terms of hatchery costs. So anyway, I'm just here to support the idea that the legislature give some guidance or some program saying we need an evaluation, a very independent evaluation that is outside of the agency, because most of the money for hatcheries comes from, quote, the outside, comes from general taxpayers, and it's a very large program. And it's if somebody says, well, if it comes from the outside, why wouldn't we be for it? And that's the problem. So, but we should still, as a public policy, look at that as if it's our own money.
That's my thank policy. You. Bill, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll take questions for both of you.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Bill Bakke with the American Fish Society. I've been involved with legislative work for, well, I don't know, 30 years, I guess, off and on. And I really appreciate the chance to present this panel and this information to the legislative committee, because in my memory, over this time, I have not encountered another opportunity where we're talking about some really serious science-based, economic-based issues that need to be reviewed and guidance provided by the legislature and moving forward on these questions. The accumulated evidence from both scientific and economic analysis over the last 130 years shows that salmon and steelhead are declining and that management investment has failed to mitigate for the loss and has been unable to recover the diversity, productivity, abundance of wild salmonids in Oregon and Northwest ecosystems. Those ecosystems that support those wild populations and the hatchery fish. The evidence suggests that our response and our investments are to curb this decline are not working. They are not working because we are more concerned about hatchery production than with restoring the productivity and resilience of salmon populations adapted to individual watersheds. The solution appears to be deceptively simple, but it isn't because the institutions we fund with public money and rely upon them to solve complex problems of salmon and steelhead recovery and watershed productivity have not been held accountable for their performance. The legislature can help solve this problem by directing the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to enlist the aid of the Department of Administrative Services to contract for a risk and benefit assessment of the fish propagation program by an independent outside source with the necessary expertise to do the work. Funding for this assessment is currently available in surpluses to ODFW's Commercial Fish Fund and other funds. It is appropriate also that the fishing interests, those who are direct beneficiaries of the hatchery program, the fishermen, be ones to help pay for that cost. The legislature should also add a performance measure for the agency that would establish a process to assure the legislature that the ODFW is complying with the recommendations that come out of this assessment of the hatchery program. Usually what we run into is a problem of we do a study, but it gets on the shelf and it never gets actually implemented. So follow-up is extremely vital. Those actions are needed. Frankly, because the evidence points out the following facts and observations. Salmon and steelhead are 3 to 5% of their historic abundance. That historic abundance may not be able to, we may not be able to recapture that if we got rid of hatcheries, but we haven't recaptured it with hatcheries either. Many populations are threatened with extinction and under federal protection. So the state is actually, in a sense, you could say losing its authority over salmon management, turning it over to the federal government. That was a big issue at one time. I think it still is a big issue. The state and the tribes and the feds are all partners in salmon recovery. But essentially, Oregon has lost its management authority because the salmon have declined to the point where they are now federally protected species. Hatchery fish survival is only about 10%. That of wild salmonids with a range of between 6 and 45%. In other words, they're not as viable in nature as our wild salmon, so we're not getting the full benefit from our hatchery production that we probably could have if we increased the survival of our hatchery fish. Hatchery fish contribute to the decline of wild salmonids through competition and genetic change. Many, if not most, hatchery programs are deficit spending programs. In other words, we're spending more than we're getting back in benefits. Hatchery productivity and cost effectiveness rely on having access to wild stocks. And that's an important issue that we need to focus on more than we have. And I think the science is bringing that out very clearly through their native brood stock evaluation programs. Is that the native brood stock, these are hatchery fish derived from wild parents, actually survive better than the traditional hatchery stock, which has been domesticated for a number of generations. So we get better survival, better contribution to the fisheries from these native brood stock fish, but they still aren't on a par with wild fish in terms of their overall survival. And as time goes on, this happens in the first generation, they survive less than their wild parents in the natural environment. And Over time, over the next few generations, they survive even less, so that we have a distance between hatchery fish survival and wild fish survival of about 40%. So they're not on a par with wild fish. So those fish are making are better than traditional hatchery fish, but what it also is telling us, if we don't have wild, healthy wild populations, then we have access to those fish to keep our hatchery programs viable, then the hatchery programs become more expensive, they contribute less to the fisheries, and they're harder to justify. So the wild fish in the hatchery program have to be not necessarily integrated, but they have to work together. So as hatchery costs increase and benefits decline, funding will become even a more critical problem as competition for dollars increases, and we're already recognizing that. Continuing the conflict between hatchery performance and cost with wild salmon productivity and recovery will continue to have a substantial impact upon the Oregon's fishing economy. And it's time to come to grips with that, and I think we need a good, sound, independent evaluation program of our hatchery program. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for any of the panel members?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We'll go with Senator Haas first and then Senator Olson.
Thank you. And thank you for your years of work on this, Mr. Bakke. You said integrated, that this could be integrated. There are a number of groups pushing for more harvest of hatchery fish and better ways to release wild fish unharmed so they can spawn, as you know. So when you say that, what do you mean? Do you see these changes to harvest as something that will benefit wild fish in our rivers?
Yeah, more selective harvest is necessary in order to harvest as many hatchery fish as you can. That keeps the stray rate down in the rivers. And then you can release unharmed your wild fish so that they continue to go contribute to the fisheries, usually on a catch-and-release basis, but also contribute to the spawning in rivers. So we're meeting our harvest goals, and we're meeting our spawning escapement goals for our wild populations with more selective fishery. And that can happen through a net fishery that's live release, and also through a recreational fishery that's based on live release.
Senator Olson?
Yes, I have a question for each gentleman. Dr. Etke, I really like your idea of independent evaluation, but my question would be, how long would that evaluation take? What would be the cost of it? And do you think if it was a good report that it could be integrated into our hatcheries?
Well, having made my living answering RFPs, requests for proposals, so on, I'm going just to throw out a number.
Have to be precise.
It could be done, I would say, within 6 months to a year. If you identify some people, and there are some good people out there that could do this work. Then on cost, my point always is you get what you pay for. You know, if I could do something like this for $10,000, but that would be superficial. You probably need something like $100,000 to $200,000. I'm just throwing this out because you asked me the question.
Is there another
question? And then the follow up to that is, if we get this report back, you think we would be able to ODFW would be able to integrate it into the system to improve the hatcheries?
Yes. Based on, I'll go back to what Dr. Chris Carter, ODFW, did on the coast some time ago. Unfortunately, that was not totally accepted. Some of the things were. There is some restructuring going on in hatcheries. We don't have to eliminate all hatcheries. One of the things that Dr. Carter found is by restructuring these hatcheries, and some made more sense than others, especially put and take fisheries made a lot of sense. And some people may not like the idea, but they made a lot of sense. The big problem about hatcheries is salmon range so far. I mean, they get eaten by everything from birds in the rivers to whiting in the oceans and so on. And so Yes. I think ODFW has listened, will listen, but they also have a lot of political pressure to continue the hatcheries system as it is.
Question for Mr. Bakke.
Okay, another question.
Mr. Bakke, on your testimony here, you say that the hatchery fish survival is only about 10% of the wild salmonoids. Is that due to predation? Is that due to angling pressure? Or is it just that the wild fish are smarter?
Well, it's probably all of those. What's really confusing to the scientists right now is they don't know why.
Can you speak in the mic, please?
So, the scientists don't really know what's going on because they from the smolt that's going out the down the river and out to the ocean and coming back as an adult, survival rate's very poor for hatchery fish compared to wild fish. And they're not exactly sure. There's more research being done trying to figure that out. The difference is alarming, and so far we haven't been able to fix it. There has been an attempt through the Hatchery Research Center that was adopted and approved by the legislature a few years ago to actually grapple with that question. Whether they've made much progress, I'm not sure.
Follow-up? One follow-up question, sir. Thank you very much. We heard several people testify as to hatchery fish interacting with wild fish on their bedding when they go up to spawn. But in the Clackamas River, for 10 years, those hatchery steelhead have been segregated from those spawning beds, but yet the wild steelhead don't seem to be rejuvenating themselves or coming back or rebounding. Can you talk about that, or do you have an answer for that?
Well, that's I'm aware of that, and that's we all expected that once they remove the non-native hatchery summer steelhead from the Clackamas that we would increase the wild winter steelhead that are listed above the dams on the Clackamas. And why that hasn't happened, I'm not sure. The thing is that once those fish go down the Clackamas from the upper Clackamas into the lower Clackamas, they're exposed to other hatchery fish competition, predation, as well as down there that are attracted to hatchery fish and the biomass that hatchery fish represent. There may be a predator barrier. Who knows what's going on? We got birds, we got seals, we have humans, all taking their part share of what's going on in terms of survival. So the impacts are. Apparently, maybe the run was so small that it can't break through the barrier of predators. That include humans as well as other wildlife.
I do have one more question.
One last, and then we're going to have to bring up ODFW.
For either person, genetically speaking, if you took a wild salmon or a wild steelhead to a hatchery fish, genetically, can you tell the difference between the two?
Well, you should probably address that to ODFW. I'm sure Ed Bowles can address that. But one thing that Ed Bowles taught me a long time ago, he says that with hatcheries you can increase production of fish, but you can't increase their productivity. And that goes to the genetic question, that those fish are no longer effectively adapted for survival in the natural environment where they spend three-quarters of their life. It's unlike livestock there where you have some control over their whole life cycle. And salmon, three-quarters of their life cycle is in nature where they have to compete and survive. And the hatchery fish just are changed enough so that they're not able to effectively survive.
May I just add, Oregon State is doing a DNA testing of salmon caught in the ocean. It's about a $2 million program funded by the feds. And they can identify the salmon by river basis. So whether that says they're different than where the wild and hatchery fish are different, that doesn't answer. But they're getting to that point, and we hope to be able to use that kind of information in future programs.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony. We're running short on time, so we're going to have the department come up and just answer a couple of quick questions, and then we're going to move on to the rest of our hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Bowles. You've already heard a couple of references to ODFW. So one would be, and I don't know if Representative Holvey is still on the phone, but if you could address the question that he raised about the pathogens and what ODFW is doing, and then maybe addressing Senator Olson's question about the differentiating between wild and hatchery fish on DNA.
Thank you, Chair Dinkfelder. My name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So I'll try to sort through some of these. You may have to remind me of some of the questions. But Representative Holvey's question was regarding the ISA virus, infectious salmon anemia virus, which has been in the news quite a bit lately. It is focused on Atlantic salmon from net penning operations, primarily within British Columbia, but also some net penning operations within the state of Washington. Washington is the only West Coast state that has net penning operations for these Atlantic salmon. Our fish health protocols do require screening of all, typical viruses that we've encountered. This is a viral sort of infection, and we have do not have within our system right now the sort of genetic lines that are required for controls to compare for this particular virus within our system. We are using the sort of tracking that is currently going on in British Columbia and Washington, which is where this potential appears to be greatest, in order to be somewhat of a bellwether for whether or not anything could happen here in our backyard. I want to mention real briefly about the virus. The virus itself has not been detected on the West Coast yet. There has been some, I'll call them genetic strands, associated with the virus in its DNA, and so it's got everybody's attention. This is a particular virus that once it does express itself, it shows up as not only a pathogen but a disease very quickly, particularly in confined settings such as net pens. And so if it is here, we are likely to see it very quickly in Atlantic salmon. We have tried to force the virus into our Pacific salmon, which is a whole different set of species, and it can be seen or it can be in them, but as far as disease expressed, that has not been able to do yet. And so our Pacific salmon are much more resistant to this virus than Atlantic salmon. If it does come, we're going to see it in Atlantic salmon, and we're going to see it very quickly. But having said that, Oregon is partnering with the federal governments and provincial governments to actually get out ahead of this, and we are looking to build into our protocols the actual genetic lines necessary to track this for any importations that we might have. Right now, we do not import Atlantic salmon, and the only way our fish could ever get exposed to this right now would be the swim bys of our north turning stocks of wild fish, of which they have not been able to find anything. But this is a very important pathogen, and we're taking it very seriously and are building it directly into our protocols.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up?
I want to see if Representative Holvey wants to follow up. If not, I do.
I don't know if he's still on the phone. Rep. Holvey, are you still on the phone?
He was on mute, so.
Yeah.
All right, let me just follow up, because your term bellwether, that concerns me. That tells me that we're waiting to see what happens, and if it happens, then we're going to react. And your second comment tells me that we shouldn't be waiting to see what happens to react. We should be on the very aggressive side, because what I understand from what Rep. Hovey shared with me is that this has devastated stocks around the world. Understand that even at the federal level, there's been some movement to try to maybe do something on the national legislative level, and I'm wondering why we aren't taking steps that would, let's say, protect our native stock by making certain that any hatcheries that are going to have any type of Atlantic salmon or any other salmon that may be vulnerable to this pathogen are somehow, let's say, barred or excluded from getting into the waterways so we don't have a devastation?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Prezansky, yes on all counts. The bellwether comment builds on that fact that this is a particular virus that is very hard to detect except for through very sophisticated genetic lines. And it doesn't really show up until it is actually in a viral form that can become expressed as a pathogen and a disease. So the Atlantic salmon, because they are so much more susceptible than any of our salmon, if it does get to the West Coast, we're going to know it very quickly, well before it actually gets into any of our sort of populations. Now, that will be the actual test of whether it actually gets here. We are already, as I mentioned, building in those precautionary protocols. We already have viral and bacterial screenings for all of our importations, eggs and fish products. We don't import any Atlantic salmon whatsoever. And we do these other testings of our hatchery fish before any releases. What we do not have is the particular genetic lines for this particular virus, and as a European and a North American strain, that is what we're acquiring now, but we are using those that have them in British Columbia and Washington in order to test their hatchery fish. Those aren't showing up, and those are right in proximity. And so this is not a crisis for us, but it is something we need to get ahead of. We are building it into our viral screening, and we'll be doing that in partnership with our state to the north and province to the north.
One follow-up.
I'll let.
Understanding that at this point we're not importing, what prohibitions, if any, do we have from keeping anyone else from bringing that type of stock into the state?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Prezansky, we basically, our line of defense against any importations that aren't directly, you know, associated with our agency are through our fish transportation permits, and all of those require any transportation of any live fish across state boundaries to follow the protocols of which these screenings are a part of. And they have to get certification for those before they can enter the state. We have different pathogens. They're categorized, you know, from the low risk to the high risk. And these represent the ISA virus as a high risk, one that will now become one that has to be certified before anything comes into the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we had one follow-up. You want to just ask your question again, Senator Olson, and then we're going to...
Just a question on the genetics of the wild species to the hatchery species, if you can actually tell the difference between the two.
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Olson, the sort of ways that we look at the genetics, you know, we can actually tell one fish from another through the fingerprinting approaches that we do now. So they do have different genetic signatures. But as far as telling a hatchery fish from a wild fish that comes from similar parentage, no, there really is not a genome distinction between those. That's really not the issue. The issue is the performance of those fish relative to their ability to either meet our objectives in the for providing fisheries or their ability to make a living in the wild, depending on the objectives. That's where our policies are focused on, Senator Olson. And I'd like to just mention those foundational policies that Oregon has have been recognized as very progressive regarding fish conservation. Those were developed in the early 2000s. The independent review that you've been talking about has occurred several times. The independent multidisciplinary science team, which is an Oregon-centered independent group, has reviewed our policies regarding native fish, our hatchery policies, and our fish health policies. and actually provided feedback. We adjusted those based on those, that feedback, and those have all been supported through the IMST. Mr. Likatowicz was actually, we were very pleased that he was able to be a part of the independent multidisciplinary science team that actually reviewed those foundational policies. The Hatchery Science Review Group, the one you mentioned from Dr. Packett, that actually reviewed all of our Columbia River Hatchery programs and our policies. And to be honest, Oregon actually was somewhat of a, well, I won't call it a poster child, but actually it was used as an example in many of those reviews of the good policies relative to progressive hatchery approach. Implementing those policies and getting them on the ground, as you heard from Dr. Packett and Mr. Likatowicz and others, is always a challenge. We could use more funding to help build in some of the reform, but maintaining stray rates on spawning grounds, those are all foundational to our current policies. And as I mentioned to you last fall, we now have 20 out of 22 conservation plans in development or in place for our anadromous. So almost all of our anadromous populations have actual criteria driving management that speaks to spawners on the spawning grounds, speaks to their performance, both to the fishery and how well they're good neighbors to wild fish. And that's all being tracked through those plans. But we're in just switching to the implementation phase of this. And so if we find stray rates are out of line, it's now the burden is on us based on our criteria to come in and adjust appropriately. And we've already done that. And I've got lots of examples of where we've already adjusted hatchery programs in light of those stray rates. But we can talk about that at another time.
So Ed, in the essence of time, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have my committee staff, Beth, follow up with you in regards to the recommendations that came out of the Hatchery Review Group. And what I'd like to know is what the status of responding to those recommendations are. So, you know, it doesn't have to be a tomb of information, but certainly what I would like is in a memo, and Beth will work with you about the format and just responding to that, so we could have a status report of where the department is on that. So with that, we're going to take a little recess here. Thank you for being here and responding to
that.
We're going to close the informational meeting on hatchery issues. Committee members, we're going to take a five-minute recess. We'll be back here in 5 minutes and start on the legislative conference. Yeah.